All right. Are you sitting comfortably? I'll cut that part out.
No, I'm not sitting comfortably, actually.
Oh, well, then get situated.
Burn manga. Especially 80s manga on. Burn these pre-programmed comics that have been churned out ever since manga turned into a business. Burn these bastard things conceived in boardrooms and born as products. For example, love stories that go on and on and on and on. Burn them. Stories about heroes beating the odds through sheer grit and friendship. Burn them. Interactive stories swinging any way the reader's surveys tell them. Burn them all. Come out of the grave, manga. Screaming and streaming blood and sweat, pages spattered with artists' crazed flesh, manga that grab and throw you deep into the warped and fucked up pit of the artist's mind itself, and leave you there, to live it. And manga, staggering on their very last legs, drawn so the artists could eat one more day. Come back. All is forgiven. For me, the manga in this collection are all greats, giants of incredible kitsch and camp. They anesthetized my brain and took me to another world. They need a bigger audience. They come from another age when manga was on par with street performance, not part of any recognized scene. The conditions were extreme. Some of these manga were drawn by people who'd have literally starved if they hadn't been paid for them that day. Just the fact that they exist is a miracle. Others were made by artists doing their stuff in nameless pulp magazines and had their series dropped by whatever grubby suits they were dealing with. Maybe the howls of outrage you hear in their work were there long before they put pen to paper. Anyway, their manga are steeped in outrage on every page. Some of these people were even working for fairly respectable outfits, driven by some blind creative urge. The moment they let these urges really rip, they found themselves kicked out far beyond the pale. Whatever. They've all gone to untimely graves. In Japan, you'll find them buried on the bargain shelves at used bookstores, or abandoned in farther reaches of rural attics. Their resale value is zero. The number of interested buyers is zero. In this book, I want to hit back at any idea that these manga are trash, lowbrow fare. I want to defend them from scorn they've been heaped with. And along with the manga themselves, I want to see these artists get the acceptance they richly deserve. It's my way of trying to put these tortured souls to rest. Manga, rest in peace.
All right, so what you just heard was not written by us. We're not that talented. It's written by Utagawa Taiko, or Takeo, is the author of a book called Manga Zombie, which is being translated by KamiPress.com, which is a terrific service to the English manga reading public, because as he sets out in his introduction, he's talking about manga that we don't usually hear. And KamiPress wrote their own kind of like intro, which I'll read, which explains more of what the book is about. Manga Zombie, written by Utagawa Takeo, was published in Japanese in 1997 by Ota Shupan. The book covers a range of 31 Japanese manga artists active primarily in the 1960s and 70s. Some of the artists are relatively well known in the English-speaking world, while others are famous or cult figures only in Japan. However, they are all, in some sense or another, outsider artists and figures of the 60s and 70s cultural underground. Most of them spent the bulk of their careers in short-lived magazines oriented towards graphic sex and violence, like Manga Erotopia. Some, however, saw success in the more prestigious publications like Garo and mass circulation mags like Shonen Jump. The selection of artists was made by Utagawa Takeo on the basis that they represent the most authentic and exciting work being done in the medium before market forces, in Utagawa-san's point of view, squeezed the artist freedom of expression to an absolute minimum in the late 70s. Utagawa Takeo is a commentator on the 60s and 70s Japanese fringe culture, concentrating mainly on the manga scene. He's the co-author of Manga Jikoku Hen, Shueisha 1997, and J.A. Caesar no Sekai, Byakuya Shobo, 2002. He's the author of Fringe Culture, Shueisha 1998, among other works. He's an informed, passionate, and critical advocate of the artist he chooses to champion. Kami Press has teamed up with Udagawa Takeo and translator John Gallagher to publish an online version of the English-language translation of Manga Zombie. This project's goal is to open up a wide range of lesser-known but valuable artists to the attention of the English-speaking world. It will help inform opinion and debate on manga and manga history in general, and will do so from an insider's perspective, while adding the background information and context necessary for the English-language reader. That's the end of the English language introduction. But I read a few chapters of Manga Zombie online, and it's all just there for free. And it's really great. They'll profile a different artist, like, history and their titles. And I found that the preface, the Japanese language preface, was so inspiring that I asked Kami Press for permission to read it on this show. And they wrote to the author, to Udagawa, and were like, can this be done, blah, blah, blah. And so the author gave permission for us to read it on the show. It's really an interesting perspective, because I've been reading a lot of Frederick Schoetz books, and it sounds like the big commercial success of manga was in the 80s. And so we kind of think of that as like the height of manga. But Udagawa is saying, no, the big success was before it became commercial, when it was a more free medium. So these are all definitely authors that you want to be reading about, and a time period that's really important. So the audio for the rest of this episode is actually from something else, from a Manga 101 panel that was hosted at the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art in New York, and it took place last November-ish, maybe December? I'm forgetting the exact date, but I'll put it in the show notes. And I did get permission to put the audio onto our show at the end of the panel, with some kind of hesitation from people at first who didn't know I was recording it. Sorry about that. The event was, I think it was supposed to be originally a panel introducing people to manga, but the people who showed up for it were either people who worked for Publishers Weekly or all of Metro Anime Club. And so it was kind of people who already really knew a lot about manga. And it kind of turned into a kind of manga industry insider chat, which was really interesting and not living up to the title at all, but still really great. So thanks to Gina for letting us record this. And the panelists that you'll get to listen to are Bridget Alverson, the moderator. And she is the maintainer and person writing mangablog.net, which links to a lot of manga reviews every single day. It also covers manga industry news. The people on the panel are John Fuller, the Kinokuniya manager in New York City. And at the time of this recording, the old Kinokuniya branch near Rockefeller Center was closing, and they were opening a new location near Bryant Park. So he might talk about the sale that was going on in December, where everything was, all the books were half off. But he was really interesting to listen to, where he specifically mentions how a lot of people go into Kinokuniya to buy tattoo books, because they're very interested in Japanese tattoos, and you don't have to read Japanese to get the full content of a tattoo book. Dallas Middaugh is on the panel, and he is the manga guy at Del Rey. And you might remember him from, I don't know, other episodes we've talked about him, and he'll introduce himself. There's Mari, who is a translator for Del Rey, but she's translated for a lot of other titles too. She's translated Saint Seiya and a bunch of other things. Mari is the one with the interesting business cards, because she's also a veterinarian. Her business cards have little animals on them, and on the front in English they say that she's a translator and also a veterinarian. On the back, it specifically lists Saint Seiya in Japanese and the other title that she's very proud of. But she's a huge manga expert, so she's an interesting person to listen to. There's someone named Brad, who I missed his last name, maybe it's in the recording, who used to work at Ballantine, and now he's a letterer at Del Rey. So he has some interesting things to say about graphic design. And I think that is most of the people on the panel. It's kind of Del Rey heavy. But I guess you'll find out during the recording. Noah also went to it, and he's kind of laughing at me. What?
Well, I'm laughing at you because we have the recording, but... Yes.
I haven't listened to it in a long time.
It's not like we're going to go back and listen and get everyone's name or figure out who...
No, I'll put it in the notes.
That would just... Why make things easier for you?
Why cheapen it? You're getting the raw experience.
You gotta work for it.
You're getting the raw Japanese experience, not even Japanese. I took notes during the panel, and some of the more interesting points were, someone brought up that Americans try and out-original each other in their works, but Japanese try and out-craft each other. And I think that's an important concept to come to grips with.
Yes.
Where the Japanese are not great innovators, they're great improvers of things. The industry professionals on the panel also talk about the narrow scope of translated manga, the genres being translated, and the time period manga is being published from is a very small range compared to what's actually out there. I think the Kami Press intro leads into that, because the authors that the guy is talking about in Manga Zombie, are not typical of what's being published here now at all. That most titles being translated are newer, and even Mari brings up that when she was, the manga that was coming out when she was young, none of that's being imported. And it's too bad because those are her favorite titles, and they're probably from the booming age of manga, and they're not really hitting our shores. People are mostly interested in newer titles, apparently. Also, the one interesting point that Dallas makes that he's a little worried that he made about in the panel is that he has a theory that manga sells really well up through volume 12 of any given series. So they like to print 12 volume or less series, because after it goes past volume 12, for whatever reason, sales plummet. People don't buy volume 13 of things. And I think it could be that there's just more and more manga to buy, or that, I don't know, that people can't seem to keep up a collection longer than that. Certainly I stopped buying The Wallflower after volume 12, because I'd stopped reading it around volume 9. I wasn't impressed. And then I've been reading Beck from Tokyopop, Mongolian Chop Squad, but I stopped collecting it after volume 6. I really like it, but it's just a lower priority, and now it's out up to volume 12. There's also a really interesting goof in the panel where the Kinokuniya manager mentioned, they ask him, is there a title that sells really well and to the Japanese customers that hasn't been selling in English? And he's like, yeah, Nodame Cantabile, like, that seems to sell really well. And they were like, oh no, that's been translated by Del Rey, it's out here up to, like, volume 11, oh, and they're all really embarrassed. It was really funny. So be sure to listen for that part. So hopefully the audio shouldn't be too bad, like other panels I've recorded. Do you have any other comments from what you remember about that night?
No, I mean, the comments that I would want to discuss I actually made during the panel, so people who listen through to the end will hear the whole thing.
Okay, during like the Q&A at the end? Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, so tonight our panel is a panel about manga, and it should be pretty excellent. We still have one panelist who called a little bit ago to say that he's getting here as fast as he can. That's John Fuller from Kinokuniya. So hopefully when he gets here, we'll be an event. And I'll leave Bridget, our moderator, to introduce everyone else.
Hi, I'm Bridget Alberson, and I'm the blogger behind Manga Blog, and I also am a comics journalist for a couple different venues, including I just actually had an article at Shoujo Beat, which is kind of cool for me. Everybody here knows way more about manga than I do, so I'm looking forward to letting them do most of the talking. On my immediate left is Dallas Mira. I'm sure you all know him already. He's the associate publisher at Del Rey Manga. And before that, he was an editor at Viz for many years.
Sales.
Stand corrected. And we also have, and I'm going to ask them to speak a little bit about themselves in a minute, Mari Morimoto, who's a translator. She's actually a veterinarian by day, translator by night. And if you read manga at all, you've probably read some of her books because she's worked on Naruto, Inuyasha. Right now, she's translating Dragon Eye for Del Rey. And on my right is Brad Folks, who is a designer who also does lettering for manga, and he's a graduate of Rhode Island School of Design. He's been a freelance designer for over 10 years, and you do mass market paperbacks for Valentine?
That's where I started.
So, sorry, so yeah. Pretty much if you've been in the airport, we've seen your work?
Oh, hopefully, yeah.
All right, so I wanted to get things rolling by just asking everybody to give a little more information about themselves, and my sort of starting question is, what are you reading right now, or what are you working on, whichever you prefer to talk about? So, Dallas, why don't you start?
The most recent Del Rey manga that I read over the weekend was Genshiken Volume 9. Is anybody out there reading Genshiken? Genshiken is a 9-volume series about, basically about being a manga fan in Japan, being a hardcore manga fan. Otaku is the term, you probably know it. And the 9th volume wraps up the storyline of all the characters, and it's just brilliant. It's such a great series. The other book that I'm reading right now is, it's called Mu, the new book that Vertical just published by Osamu Tezuka. I just can't get enough Tezuka. Anything Tezuka that comes out, I just buy instantly. It's a fantastic book.
My apologies.
No problem. We just started.
Okay, very good.
This is our fifth panel member is John Fuller, and he is the manager of Kinokuniya. Am I pronouncing that right?
That's correct. Yes.
I'm sure you guys have, if anybody's been on the internet, you've seen they had an awesome event just a week ago. Go anyway, was there doing the girls. So the first question I'm asking everybody is what they're reading right now. And I'll just fill in your background.
What I'm reading right now. I'm reading the background on Atlantis, so it's not comic or anything like that. do you want a little background?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've been at Kinokuniya for over 20 years. And if you're not familiar with Kinokuniya, it's the Japanese book chain that we deal with a lot of manga. So it's a comic genre, but it's the Japanese comics that you're probably familiar with it. But anyway, we almost were drawn into it kicking and screaming over the years from our customers just loving the subject. So I'm in it more from a professional view. I've read a few manga, but I'm not a real big manga reader. So your questions to me will probably be a little more on the professional level. So that's my background.
Yeah.
In that case, yeah.
What are you, Marian and Brad? Is that good? Marian?
Actually, the funny thing is I've been a manga reader before I was a manga fan and then a manga professional. And I still remember the days when I used to sneak into Kinokuniya with my parents and sneak upstairs and read all the books since they weren't shrink-wrapped yet. But what am I reading now? Well, and this is not just because my editor is sitting in the back, but I'm currently working on the second half of Dragon Eye Volume 5. 3 is hitting the press, or hit the press and hitting the bookstores.
Just this last Tuesday, right?
Okay.
This last Tuesday.
And I really tell people to keep up with it. I know Volume 1 was a little slow, but the action really starts picking up, and it's really cool. It's pretty sophisticated for a shonen manga, which I like, because I think a lot of shonen manga are starting to become more about action and not as much about plot. But in terms of personally, I just ripped off the shrink wrap and started reading on the subway over, which is what all manga people do. You just kind of read it throughout and carry it around. It's called Neko Ramen, or Cat Ramen. And in this little bit I've written, it's a 4-panel comic book about a cat that opens a ramen store. So it's kind of like What's Michael meets Tampopo, okay, and all the trials and tribulations thereof. And everything else I think we'll cover in the what manga hasn't been translated that we'd like to see translated. So
yeah, which is a good one. Brad?
Well, what I'm reading now, I'm starting the Cyborg 009 series. Yeah, just I've had that on the shelf for a while, and I just wanted to make sure I got a few of them together so I could just read them all in one sitting. And also, I keep up with The Case Closed. It's just fun and entertaining, the book, the series that is. I don't watch the show. But no, I started in books. You're right, in Ballantine. In the mid-80s, I started Ballantine, but then I moved out of the mass market books and moved on to trade hardcovers and so forth. And then got into manga a few years ago, and just, you know, obviously, cascading, you know, the banks, the money's flying out, buying the books. It's just the library at home is growing. But that's where I'm very happy that I'm in it right now.
Good. The first thing, since this was billed as a Manga 101 panel, I thought it would be appropriate for us to start really with a basic definition of terms, and I don't think it's necessarily as straightforward as you might think, to ask, what is manga? How do you define manga? Is it Japanese? Is it Asian? Is it anything that's black and white in a 5x8 format? John, you sell the stuff. What do you think?
Well, manga is originally a Japanese word. It is pictures, I guess, with graphic pictures describing a story. Manga could be described as having come out of the ukiyo-e, actually. I've heard Yoshitoshi is an ukiyo-e artist, and they say that he helped develop this kind of a graphic structure where panels then turn into a story. So some people will like to meet and claim that Japan started comics in general, and it started before the Europeans did, but I'm not going to say anything like that. But in any case, manga is a Japanese word, so the manga format is the Japanese format of comics. And it's taken off and grown into something more than that now, obviously, because you're having manga that's done all over. But I think it differentiates itself from US Marvel-type comics in that the stories are kind of a Japanese way of telling, and they have a different, they're cute, they're at the same time often very violent, they cross over into different genres, they're very sexual in some cases, but in any case they're a Japanese format originally, and then they've developed out of that. So that's all I
want to have. Dallas, maybe as an editor, you can expand a little bit on the difference in storytelling structure between manga and Western comics.
Well, there are a lot of differences. There are a lot of differences that exist. I mean, I work as the publisher for Del Rey Manga, so I don't get in and edit a lot of the books myself. But over the last few years, I've noticed some really basic things. The art style in manga tends to be more cinematic. Very often, you really can think of the panels almost as camera shots and camera angles. There's less of a reliance, if you want to compare manga directly to contemporary superhero comics, there is much more of an emphasis on dialogue in manga consistently than there is in that category, that genre of superhero.
Much to the bane of the translator who has to translate all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't have to, so it's okay. So that's part of it as well, is that, you know, the manga more than some American genres relies on a combination of art and dialogue and not captions and not thought balloons, not an interior monologue, but everything is very exterior. You'll also find when you're looking at manga compared with an American style, this is, you probably can't see from back there, but they really get a little more funky on the layout. They really, very, very rarely will you find manga working in a 4, 6, or 9 panel grid. The page is designed to take your eye around the page. It's not to say that American or any other type of comic doesn't do that. It's simply one of the things that manga more consistently does, I would say. Matt Thorne, who you had mentioned earlier, actually pointed out on the web something I had never noticed before. In manga, for some reason that nobody really knows exactly for sure, and I think you can see this from here, the space separating the panels vertically is very thin, and the space separating the panels horizontally is really thick. It's true for all manga. All of it. I mean, pick up any manga, and you will find that that is true. I have no idea why.
Greg, do you know why?
No. Sorry. I didn't do it out, but no. I just had a comment about the art styles and how, you know, you're talking about cinematic approach and so forth, but it's also neat, just the wonderful variety. That's all I can think about it. Mm-hmm. The variety of titles that we work on, the 11 of them, about 6 or 8 of them. They are very, even though they're very similar, that's the points you pointed out, but it's nice to see such a variety, you know, like Love Roma. It's very, you know, it definitely is stilted from, but it varies from Ghost Hunt and all the other titles that we work on.
Nice. You know, I don't want to derail this, and I know you want to say something too, but I want to mention one thing. An analogy I use when I'm talking to people who aren't familiar with manga is to say what it's most similar to in America is actually not an aspect of publishing. It's most similar to television. People who are not familiar with manga will attempt to pigeonhole it into a genre, and it's not. It's a bit like if somebody were to come to you who never watched American television and they said, so what's American television like? Well, there's CSI, there's, you know, Seinfeld, there's The Simpsons, there's The Evening News. All of those things exist in manga in Japan. That's what it's most similar to, really, I think, in terms of genres and storytelling styles.
I think actually, too, that from a manga artist's point of view, definitely something that I've known friends of mine who are manga artists say too, is that they're always confused by American fans asking them, show me how to draw manga, because it's not a style the way, in the perception of manga artists, the way that comic book art is, or as a perceived genre perhaps. Maybe it's not even an actual genre, an American art style as well. Because most of my manga artist friends are like, you just draw, that's all it is. And you know, there are the stereotypes, and this is maybe more an anime stereotype than truly a manga stereotype, which another thing that manga artists point out is a lot of American artists who draw what in the manga style draw more of an anime style than a manga style, but the big eyes, yeah, the non-Japanese look to characters. Like Dao said, you know, when you say manga, it's just a different type of representing stories. So there's prose, and then there's manga. It's just a different format. And that's why you find so many literary genres within manga as well, is because it's just a different format of showing the word on the page.
We really get tripped up. It's very hard to define manga. But I actually can give you the most mercenary, sales-oriented description of manga. It's 5x7.5, it's black and white, and it's about $10. That's what gets you into the manga section of the bookstore, is just doing this format.
from a literal standpoint, it means humorous drawing or humorous art. So it does.
So they got stuck with the comic book name too.
Comic art, not book, but comic art.
Yeah.
Just like because manga, ga is art or drawing, and man is kind of humor or comic. Just like manzai is a form of stand-up comic genre that's common in the Osaka Kyoto area of Japan. So for some reason that's translated over, even though the words kind of did not come from any other language.
Interesting.
One of the things that pops up a lot, and actually Dallas and I were talking about today when we were talking about Pretty Face, the basic plot of Pretty Face is summed up in the blurb on the back of the book. He wanted to be her boyfriend, but he'd settle for being her twin sister. Which wraps like actually a lot of the shoujo manga tropes into one. I don't know if anybody actually meets by crashing into someone else, but it seems like manga uses a lot of similar, and maybe it's just a function of what we're seeing, but there seem to be a lot of similar plots. And I wonder if you'd talk a bit about what you see as being really the characteristic stories of manga. And Mara, you see much more than we do because you get to see the untranslated stuff.
Well, part of the reason why I always itch when this question comes up is because there's definitely trends that happen over decades as well, and unfortunately the trends that we can describe now, and especially what's in the bookstores now and will be in the bookstores, are the trends from anywhere from probably the very late 90s, but definitely the 21st century. So a lot of the, you know, most popular shonen, I mean, it's kind of almost interesting to say that it is like television in that once something hits recently, everyone else tries to copy it, especially within that publisher. I mean, you still have like a Shogakukan shonen title is still more similar to Shogakukan shonen titles, which are different from Shueisha shonen titles.
Those are the Japanese publishers.
From Kodansha, you know. But even so, like within Shueisha, within Shogakukan, within Kodansha, a lot of the shonen titles are very similar. It's just, is it pirates or is it ninja? You know, I mean, but they both involve these, you know, kind of underdog boys that, you know, fight their way to the top, you know, or become heroes or something like that. And I've seen the similar trend happen in shoujo, which you didn't necessarily, or at least I never saw it growing up, whereas I saw a lot different plots in shoujo titles, especially from the 70s and 80s and even early 90s, which I love, but I'm really frustrated at because we're never going to see them translated in the near future. So
You also have to bear in mind that what we consider to be manga in the United States is actually a fairly narrow subset of what manga is in Japan. I've spoken with a number of Japanese editors who've come to the U.S. They go to a Borders or a Barnes & Noble. They look at the shelves, and all they're seeing is the shonen and shoujo adventure titles. I mean, they're not seeing, I mean, there's a bookstore called a bookstore chain called Junkudo in Japan, in Ikebukuro. The bottom floor is manga. So embarrassing, that's my fault. The bottom floor is manga. That floor is the equivalent of what you would find in a Walden Books or something like that here.
John, you must see a much broader range than we do.
Well, he's right about it. The amount that's been translated in English is very limited. We have more complaints actually at our store about how little Japanese literature has been translated in English. A lot more manga is being translated. Mm-hmm. So it's good to see that, and it's increasing. I'll say this, in our store, the Japanese manga section has been, you know, like 80%, and then the English 20% 5 years ago, and now it's about 40% English and 60% Japanese, and that's rapidly expanding. And also, the event that we had at our store with Inoue Takahiko was significant in that his manga are now being translated simultaneously with the Japanese. So 27 just came out, both in English and Japanese. And we can get 26 at our store. We don't have 27 in English
yet. That lead time is shrinking.
That lead time is shrinking. 27 in English should be there shortly. So, but that's Vagabond. Now, some other are quite far behind now. There's the a Japanese manga now called No Dame Kantabire, which is about music. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you'll ever see it in English, but it's very, very popular.
We publish it. Excuse me. We're on the 10th volume.
But okay, my apologies again. I look at the bestseller list at our store and I see the Japanese coming up at the top, but I haven't seen the Monami on the English side yet. So, but Vagabond is definitely always top, either in Japanese or in English. And that's quite remarkable. It even compares better than Naruto does, which I think does well everywhere. But that's the unique Kinokuniya brand of that, and I apologize.
Please don't worry. It's fun to make fun of you for it, but don't worry.
Do you have a lot of non-Japanese readers coming in and buying the Japanese manga?
Yes.
Is that a big part of your
Yes, it is. It's the more serious comic buyer, though. That takes a lot of effort to go in and get your Japanese to the level where you can read a Japanese comic. But some people do it for that very reason. And some do it, I believe, just so they can read ahead in the series that they love so much that they can only get volume 15 in English and they can get 36 in Japanese. So I mean, you see that happening as well. Also, and perhaps the people here can tell me better about the internet sites that have translations of the Japanese. So you can pick up the Japanese version of a lot of the comics and then go online and get the English translation unofficial. You know, again, the publishers may not want to hear that. It's something that you can do, and it does drive sales of the Japanese manga as well to non-Japanese speaking customers.
Brad, maybe you could talk about some of the visual tropes of manga, things that pop up again and again.
It depends. Again, when it comes down to the individual artist, I find that when I first started getting this, and I had friends who would come up and always talk about the certain styles would be the large eyes and the hair and certain characteristics. But as I've been getting into it, there are some traits, the simplicity of the face, all this little nuances for noses and so forth, just the styles. But I do find less and less the large hair. The titles that I work on, the titles that I enjoy, don't have that. It just varies from ours, and that's what I enjoy now so much, is I'm not seeing when I started that you'd always hear about certain ones that would always be set the standard. Everyone thinks back to also to the early like Speed Racer or something. That's,
yeah,
I think, what people lock into.
Kind of
but the more I've delved into this, the exposure to all the different types of artists that I see, it's just hard for me to pin down a specific characteristic. Like, right? Again, I can start listing a general look, but then you have, again, Love Roma, which really didn't fit the mold which I was fortunate to work on. But it's nice to see those kind of pop up.
One of the interesting things to me, though, is, for instance, even a really serious manga will have somebody suddenly go chibi in it.
Oh, yeah.
That, to me, is bizarre.
Yeah. No, even on the more serious ones, the one we work on also is Ghost Hunt, and it involves a paranormal moment. And all of a sudden, there's a character in May, and she is kind of like this, I don't want to say the straggler, but she knows, the little one. And then sometimes when her love interest says something to her or something, she all of a sudden converts to a smaller character and a more juvenile, exaggerated pose comes out. And then poof, it goes back into the standard style of the book. For some reason, it just pops out. I think it's...
Yeah, the reverse too, where like you have a total comic genre and then comedy genre, and then when a character gets serious, he suddenly gets drawn a lot more serious and handsome. And the prime example is in Dr. Slump, where the mad scientist Dr. Slump, you know, or Professor Norimaki, all of a sudden when he gets serious, he looks like an American movie star. He's like, suddenly he sucks in and like he's like all serious, and then he goes back to being like the pot-bellied, you know, 40 something like mad scientist that he is.
I mean, I can appreciate the device of doing that, but also even the more subtle ones, such as the little teardrop. Or in the bubble, you will have the burst or the vein or whatever.
The little anger sign.
Yeah, the little anger sign. That's just enough. Instead of altering the artwork, just in the bubble itself, you also indicate how the translation's approach.
And my personal favorite, a nosebleed to indicate sexual frustration.
Yeah.
Or some embarrassment.
Right. It's almost always. Okay.
Since John brought it up, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was Scanlation's. Pirates or tastemakers? Who wants to start with that one?
Pretty much, yeah.
Where do you think it's going? I mean, I think I see the scanlation scene, not that I'm really tied into it all that well, but it seems to be evolving from, you know, a few really hardcore fans working on IRC, doing downloads. A lot of people, I mean, you can now of course go online and read all of Naruto for free and everything else. I mean, which that, they're not even scanlations really. There do seem to be a lot of active scanlation groups though, working on titles that probably will never be translated into English or not in the near future. And yet, at the same time, there's so much more manga. Are they becoming irrelevant? Dallas?
Which, scanlations or printed books?
Scanlations. I just assume, for all of our sakes, that printed books will be around for a little while.
Scanlations are a very tricky thing for manga. Manga as would not be as popular as it is now if scanlations had not happened. There's just no two ways about that. Scanlators were, and anime and manga fans have always been early adopters. Anime fans were the first to make the shift to DVD. They were the ones who put, you know, by putting all of these titles online and making them available to some, to people who wanted to download them, they create this demand for it. So there's a lot to be said for it. The other edge of that sword is that once the series does start to come out here, yes, a few responsible scanlators will take them off their website, but only a few. And those scanlations do exist. You know, you're left with something like what Viz did with Naruto, and it'll be very interesting to see if it works. I think in an effort to lessen that distance between the latest English version and the latest Japanese version, they released 16 books over the course of 4 months, I think.
3 months for 4 months.
And you know what's interesting about that, and I'm a total geek about tracking sales numbers. When Naruto would come out over the past couple of years, it would hit the top of the charts and it would just sit there. And there were several weeks at the end of 2006, beginning of 2007, when the top 10 list was a list of 10 volumes of Naruto. Now that they're doing 3 a month, they're dropping fast. They're selling great. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not like pronouncing the death of Naruto, but they have fundamentally altered the way Naruto sells by putting it out this way.
And that was a concern that I actually raised to my editors when I first got the call saying, hey, you know, we're thinking about doing this. And as a translator, I was directly affected in terms of input-output, the rate at which, and one of the things that it was a good decision empirically in terms of the fact that even without scanlations, I think fans would have been upset that how far behind Naruto is lagging compared to the anime, compared to how it's coming out in Japan. From a practical standpoint, I was very concerned about the sales because, you know, the main audience of Naruto are kids who are getting an allowance to go and get a book per month and not 3 books per month. And what about all these new titles that are coming out from other publishers or even from Viz itself? And it affected me directly because at the rate at which they were asking me to put it out with all the other titles I was handling, they had to hire extra translators to work on it. So I was also concerned from a content point of view, from the standpoint of consistency. Because I had started working from, I think, volume 2, either the end of volume 1 or beginning of volume 2, and I had pretty much been the only person on the Naruto team that stayed the same. The rewriter had changed, the current editor is probably the 4th or 5th editor on the series. The managing editor had changed, so I was also really concerned about how we'd be able to pull this together and make sure that it still read the same, too.
And is it working?
We have time to read the books? I haven't had a chance to because we're finally back on a more leisurely pace of Naruto, which is still quicker than it was originally. And I'm still waiting to get all the in between volumes, the intermediate volumes. So I haven't had a chance to check the overall arc. I mean, so far it looks good, but I'm also waiting to hear what the sales numbers are and what the fan reaction. I know right before when fans first got an inkling that this was gonna happen, there was a lot of negative feedback, the same points that I brought up. Consistency, would we be able to buy so many volumes in so short a period? But I haven't had a chance to actually gauge fan reaction afterwards. So I don't know. I mean, I can just say my life's a little bit easier now, and I'm starting to catch up on all my other titles too. But I think it's nice for fans to be able to read more than what's available. Mm-hmm. The other concern I have about scanlations is when, obviously, the scanlation is first, and people take that version of the English to be the god. So when an actual publisher prints their volume, they're like, okay, this is inconsistent, this is wrong, why did they translate it this way?
Because I would think that the translation quality would be pretty inconsistent with scanlations.
Yeah.
Some, yes, some. Again, there's no quality control. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I know that there are some good translators out there working on stuff, but there are ones who use machine scan translations, and that certainly has, you know, a lot to be desired. The other thing is, you give 10 professionally working translators the same volume and they'll come up with 10 different scripts. And then give them to 10 different editors and you'll get even more change. So, I mean, I think the way that Viz does it, where it's, you know, clearly says adaptation and not translation, is kind of a way to go. And that's how I kind of try to explain it, where, you know, we're not claiming it's necessarily a faithful word-to-word translation, because that wouldn't even read well,
right,
for the most part. Right. So it's an adaptation, and it's Viz's version of, it's kind of like take it with a grain of salt, but I do get that question a lot. It's a hard question too. It's especially a hard question if I just did the first pass translation, I didn't do the rewriting.
Yeah.
So what ends up on the page may not have been what I submitted to begin with.
Right. There is often that extra step in manga where it's first translated and then adapted or rewritten, and you'll always see that on the credits. That there's a rewriter. And one book that I reviewed just this past week was Battle Royale, which was adapted by Keith Giffen. And I don't read Japanese, so I can't really speak to this, but he really changed the language and, in fact, slightly changed the plot of the story as well.
And fans love that.
That's a tough one, you know? Because he claimed that he was making it more readable, and the guy is a comic book writer, so he was certainly using his abilities, but at the same time, he radically changed what was there, which a lot of people don't like.
Now, what the fans have said to us over and over again over the years is that what they want is as close to the Japanese as possible. That's what they want. They don't want the reference to, you know, to a Japanese pop singer replaced by a reference to Britney Spears. They don't want the reference to a classic Japanese film replaced by a reference to Star Wars. There was a time when things like that were happening. The fans have made it very, very clear to us how much they don't like that.
One of the other things that's really kind of shaping the manga world, and Naruto, the Naruto Blitz is part of it, is shelf space. If you have a, I don't know what, 56 volumes of Inuyasha, ultimately, you don't want people to bomb out at volume 13 because they can't find it in the bookstore, and yet at the same time, there's more coming out. Now, I was in Kinokuniya today, and he had an encyclopedic... How do you think that's changing manga?
It's a battle.
Really?
It's a fight the whole time, yeah.
Is it a Darwinian thing, the weakest
It's Darwinian. Yeah, I hate to say it, but it is. It really depends on the buyer. I'm not the manga buyer. I haven't done manga. I was more into language and things like that when I was doing actual buying. When we were at the Rockefeller Center still, which we're, by the way, to give you a plug, we're having a 50% off sale.
Including manga?
Everything in stock, every book in stock, because it's closing at the end of December. So the new store at Bryant Park is then where everything will be carried on after that. But you can get some good deals right now. But the Rockefeller Center store was a big battleground, actually. And the manga used to be up on the second level in the mezzanine, that we called it, yes. And we had a lot of people that gravitated up there. But we discovered, you know, we get orders and things from the headquarters in Japan all the time. And they said, what are you going to do now to improve your sales? And we had some powwows over the years of what things we could do. So somebody put me on the spot and they said, okay, what are you going to do now? You're the manager, do it. So we moved the manga from the mezzanine down to the ground floor, expanded it, put it next to the English books, and wow, within a month or so, 170% response.
Wow.
So
titles that are still in Japanese?
Everything.
Everything together.
We, you know, in Kinokuniya anyway, it's nice, we like to put the English and the Japanese together. We do it in the tattoo section, as a matter of fact, because we have a lot of local people looking for Japanese design and tattoo books. doesn't matter how the book is written. The designs are what are important. And if you find them in the English section or in a section that's accessible to a non-Japanese speaking customer, it works. So this is what we found. And though we don't have the Japanese Naruto next to the English Naruto, they're close enough that you can, you know, get them within an easy walking distance, and you can browse through everything and enjoy all of that. So that's what we discovered. So the new store, manga's back on the second floor, but the second floor is very exciting. So we're hoping that that's still successful, but it's expanded. It's bigger. I think you'll see that if you come in. And that store is on 6th Avenue between 40th and 41st Street, across from Bryant Park. Thank you. Did I answer your question?
I think so. I think what I'm looking at is how the battle for shelf space is changing the industry. Does it mean that I'm never going to get to see a physical copy of Firefighter Dago?
Pretty much.
Although Shayna Garrity is doing her best to push back. If you don't read Shayna Garrity's Life Journal, you really should, because she picks up on all the obscure manga that you can't find anywhere, and she does wonderful things.
She's also the editor on on Saint Seiya, which is, you know, still surviving.
It's becoming a shonen-esque battle, though. I will stay on the shelf.
Yeah. Well, you know, you actually, in talking about those two series, you talk about the flip side from a publisher's perspective of keeping books on the shelves, which is, it's certainly worth thinking about. Inuyasha is apparently going to go on like a couple hundred volumes, and God bless.
Job security.
And that's great, because and Inuyasha is really good, and it has a fan following. The problem is, purely from the publisher's perspective, is that we don't know which titles are going to succeed. Sometimes we do. I mean, sometimes they're no-brainers. When we launched with Negima and Tsubasa, these were by Ken Akamatsu and Clamp. They had a following. We knew they were going to blow through. But as you start to do more books, and you start to take a few more chances, every now and again you sign up for a series, and you think, let's do it, let's go. It goes into the bookstore for the first volume, it doesn't sell, and the buyer never brings it in again. Meanwhile, it's doing so well in Japan that they're gonna go to 50 volumes, and as a publisher, we are obligated to complete the series. It's tricky. It's tricky.
I can imagine that.
It's why, in all honesty, you know, I mentioned before, what manga you see here is a narrow subset of what's available in Japan. That's part of the reason, you know. Financially, it's very dangerous for us to take risks, especially with a series that's really long.
But the interesting thing, though, is that's a recent trend in Japan, too. Until now, you only had children's series and certain long-standing series that really went beyond even 20 volumes or 28 volumes. I know that Saint Seiya got a lot of flack for going to 28 volumes, and it would have gone longer, but Shueisha actually cut them off because sales were dropping. The anime had ended for the time being, and it wasn't doing so well, and Shueisha cut it off. Until Dragon Ball, really, it was...
That's what I was going to say.
Dragon Ball was really what changed it, and now, I think, in reverse, when you do have a, unfortunately, cash cow, I think that's why Inuyasha has gone 50-plus, is because they realized that it was selling, and so they were going to push it for as much as they could. Naruto
really
is 40-plus at this point, 41-plus. It was unheard of until Dragon Ball came along and was 41 or 42 volumes total.
Can I tell a Dragon Ball story I heard while I was at this?
Go for it.
It might be apocryphal. It might not be true. So the story goes, you know, Akira Toriyama was working on Dragon Ball Z, and he reached a point somewhere around like the 25th volume where he was like, okay, I'm done. At this point, Shueisha's Shonen Jump magazine had reached a circulation of a little over 8 million copies a week, which is the highest that it has ever hit. It's at about a quarter of that now. And his editors basically said to him, no, I don't think you're done. And if you read Dragon Ball Z, you know, it's broken into Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z. Dragon Ball is brilliant. I mean, it's an amazing series. And if you haven't read it, it's really fantastic. It's one of the best manga I've ever read. Dragon Ball Z starts out really strong and then suddenly becomes these mindless, repetitive battles that just go on for pages and pages and pages.
And it didn't even really end, because at the end all he does is fly off saying, see you again sometime, kind of thing, you know, or farewell for now.
For another
or,
sequel?
Yeah, potentially. I mean,
potentially.
I mean, and that was a marketing strategy, and the point of this was Dragon Ball is 42 volumes, and they split it up into 16, where it was really 16 plus the first couple chapters of 17 into Dragon Ball, which is the story of Goku growing up, and then 17 on, which is really the story of his sons, and then put them out simultaneously in English. So, and it worked, because otherwise you would have the series that went on forever. So
Yeah. It does seem like, I don't know if there's like an optimum length for a series. With Tokyo Pop, their original global manga were all these three volumes, which are kind of nice, except that it's a year between volumes, which is bad. I mean, do you think that there's such a thing as being too long?
Oh, absolutely.
At what point do they jump the shark? At what point do they lose the energy?
Volume 12.
I mean, Inuyasha's getting to that point where I'm kind of like, okay, Takashi, you're obviously trying to lengthen the time. Because if you read the first volume, you know where the story is going. I mean,
right. The
shard breaks apart and they're looking for all the pieces. And they've been on the last piece for the last 10 volumes so far. You know, so...
I wasn't kidding. I actually do believe it's volume 12. I call it... came up with this myself, the manga event horizon. No, listen, there's different types of manga out there in the market. All of us publishers are happy when we have a Negima, a Fruits Basket, a Naruto. There's less than 10 series like that that are selling that well in the market overall. Most of the manga that's out there is not selling that well. If you're not at the absolute A level, what happens is, the longer the series goes on, you eventually reach a point, whether it's at volume 5, volume 8, volume 12, where you start to lose readers. And that's a problem. That doesn't happen to Naruto. It doesn't happen to Negima. These are super high profile. New people are coming in all the time. I'm not going to name any series, but it happens to series all the time, you know? Which is interesting, because it doesn't really happen in Japan. They're pretty steady and even continue to climb in Japan, even the lower selling series. I forgot which question
you bring up an interesting point. And one of the things that when Tokyo Pop and Del Rey did it too, started putting out the omnibus editions, one of the things when I talked to Rob Tokar about Battle Royale, he said was, well, we have to keep it in front of readers, you know? And this is a new way, it gets it back on the shelves, it's a new presentation, it's got a little bit more. I think there's also maybe an advantage to the omnibus editions, because a lot of books don't really get rolling in volume one. I think if I'd only read volume one of Battle Royale, I might not have stuck with it, but with three in a volume, you know, by the end of that omnibus, I was hooked. So I don't know, what do you think?
Well, the interesting thing is the Japanese publishers are doing that too. I mean, first you had the Tankobon, and then, I actually don't have any on me, but then now they have the Bunkobon, which is kind of one and a half tankobons in that, and then some of them have the super giant form. They don't have the omnibus the way it's a three volume in one, but they've played around, and I think that's why you see some sales go up, is because they put out a new format. So you have new readers plus old diehard collectors who get the newer type of volume as well.
So they can complete their collection.
The interesting thing about the omnibus editions, and I'm curious what people's take is on this, is that from a buyer's perspective, it means buying fewer books, which is a good thing. But from a shelf space perspective, I don't understand, because that volume of Battle Royale, that's one volume, three volumes in one, is only about a quarter of an inch less wide than three volumes together. I don't really see how in the long run this is going to solve our shelf space crisis.
But it's a new product, so it moves off the shelf, I think.
Yes, that's
true. That's the idea.
That's true.
The idea.
That's true.
Brad, what kind of challenges do you have in terms of designing the manga, keeping it fresh and keeping people interested in it?
Well, for the lettering, it's hard to explain, actually. It's what do you mean?
Do you retouch?
I don't get
to. Let me ask you a real technical question.
No.
Do you retouch the?
No, I don't.
The sound effects, you don't.
No, we don't remove them. What we do at Del Rey is we leave the sound effects. So the sound effects are outside bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that go across the large background. So, but all we do is put in a slight translation, because we want to keep the integrity of the frame we want to make sure that the intonation, or whatever you wish to call it, of the scream, of the sound effect, is there. And put the translation beside it so the Japanese can come through. We have started to put the sound effects inside bubbles. We started to translate those, but alter them, make them look different than text, and try and give them a different feel so people don't get too confused about this is text and this is a sound effect. But the fun part about lettering is, even though it's pretty straightforward, which you would consider straightforward, we try and vary it. We were just talking about this today. So instead of it just being all the same all the way through, you know, exaggerating text for screams and yells and excitement and whispers are very tiny. Yeah, so it's fun to play around with that a little bit, still trying to keep the flow of the story going, of course. But
And that happens in the Japanese as well, doesn't it?
It's funny because sometimes, again, we were talking about this earlier, some titles, no. Sometimes I found it's consistent all the way through. Ghost Town or whatever, sometimes, and not faulting them or anything, but it's when I translate or when I letter it, I like to put a little bit of variety in it to vary the communication. If they're yelling, obviously I would want to make it a little louder to get the point across. And of course they would have the jagged bubbles as a scream or something like that. Whereas if you look at the Japanese, some, only some, will keep the font size perhaps all the same. But again, this varies from manga to manga. I mean, it depends on the letter of the Japanese.
Right.
I found it both ways.
So there's no consistent style?
No. Unless you guys found, on the whole, there's some...
Japanese, as a language, in manga, can be very subtle. I remember once very early on at Viz, I sent in a script and got the comment back, what is all this extra punctuation? Because I put in all these question marks, explanation points, and like, they're like, it's not in the original, don't use it in your script. And I said, well, that's because you can ask a question in Japanese without putting a question mark at the end. Mm. It's just a very subtle question. So, you know, that's kind of involved too, where it's kind of like the translator's job to educate the editor too, when they're paying enough attention to the page where they can be like, okay, that doesn't look like what was on the page originally. So... That can be something, and I've tried to be more conscious about the letter now too, where there are certain things, and Delray did a really good job of educating me about saying, you know, if there are things that should just be left alone, like if it's just ellipses or if it's an exclamation by itself in a bubble, just put leave as is.
Right.
And I think that, you know, that makes the process easier further steps ahead.
I think we try to, like for instance, yes, we were talking about the actual certain punctuation, the squiggle lines, your thought lines, thought bubbles. Those we try and keep. If it's in the Japanese and they have that little squiggle or the straight line with the three vertical ellipses, we try and mimic that. But yes, if there's a... sometimes it doesn't work with the translation and then there's a straight line. Sometimes for visually it doesn't fit or the translator doesn't want it that way or the adapter doesn't want it that way. But I'd like to try and keep as much of the Japanese as possible when it comes to just the punctuation or something like that. Just again, I think, like Dallas said earlier, the readers want what the Japanese had.
Right.
So we try and keep that consistent. Right. Of course, I have no control over the translation or the adaption, but I try and
keep the look
the same.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point, because one of the real kind of watersheds of manga publishing was the decision, 5 years ago to stop flipping it. And now that's pretty standard, except for a few things like Vertical Edition. We're talking about Vertical Edition, Tezuka's classic manga. Are not flipped. I've seen the argument made that it's better because it's more authentic. I've seen the argument made that it's worse because English still reads left to right, so you're doing a more complicated zigzag of the page. I'd just like each of you to sort of speak to what you think. Flipping, good or bad? Or does it depend?
But I'm just so used to it now that And of course, I don't read the Japanese, I only read the English. Even though it reads, you know, we read ours from left to right for the text, mm-hmm. but flip it. I just can't think of it any other way. And I do read both, actually, so because I do read, you know, just reading, whether it's Astro Boy or Phoenix or, you know, any of those, reading however you wish to lay it out. I can easily switch, and I think most manga readers can jump back and forth. I don't think... Perhaps if I gave it to my mom and I said, "No, try this," you know, she might go, "What?" You know, but I think everyone has been conditioned—not in a negative way—but to read it this way. This is just how it is done, and we will have to jump over the hurdle that our English reads, you know, left to right.
I think it makes it easier for the letterer, though, because I remember there are titles that, when I worked on flipped editions, where I'd have to point out areas that could not be flipped because it was a musical note that would look odd flipped, or if it was written in Roman letters, in English letters, that, you know, wasn't part of the plot or dialogue, but if it was art, so it couldn't be flipped. And, for example, One Pound Gospel, Takahashi the Japanese series just ended, and Viz is putting out the fourth and final volume in English, but because the first three volumes were flipped, we are flipping the fourth volume as well, even though Viz no longer flips.
Is Inuyasha still flipped?
No, Inuyasha, I believe, is coming out unflipped, yeah. But I think the first couple of volumes were...
They reissued those volumes.
Oh, really?
Did they? Yeah, in an unflipped
form. I think Del Rey had one of the classics with Parasite.
Right.
The flipping really almost changing.
In Parasite, the basic story is that an alien parasite, a spore, becomes lodged in this young man's arm. And when Tokyopop published it, they flipped it. And so it was in the guy's left arm, and so the parasite was nicknamed Lefty. Oh, when you read it in the Japanese, it's not flipped, it's in his right arm, so you can't call it Lefty anymore, and Righty really isn't a good name.
Oh.
So yeah, we went with Mugi, which is Japanese for right, when we did ours. But I do have another great story from that I got from Viz. I got all my great stories from Viz, apparently.
That's been quite a play.
It really was. When I was there, we published a book by Kawaguchi called Eagle, The Making of an Asian American President, which is one of the best manga that I'm actually glad to see some of you have read it. It was not a big seller. It takes place in the United States, and this was in 2000, I want to say. Maybe it even started coming out in 99. It takes place in the US. Now, the book was flipped because that was what everybody did at the time. But that meant this book that took place in the real world would now have had everybody driving on the left-hand side of the road because you flip the image.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what, you know, again, this is like 1999, what Carl Horn, who's since gone on to Dark Horse, did, he was so meticulous about this. He would take the film and he'd put it down and he'd go to every panel where there was a road and he'd get out his knife and he'd go, and he'd cut out the exact shape, and he'd take it, and he'd flip it over, and then he'd seal it back into place. And he did this. If you ever read Eagle, when you see that the cars are on the right side of the road, Carl was sitting there cutting the film for every single panel to make sure it would look like that. And that's why we don't flip anymore.
Well, I'd imagine the American flags would have been an issue, too.
You probably took care of those.
Do you find that people...
No.
It's an issue? People pick them up and go, oh, this is backwards?
No, but they're well-labeled now. I think, again, the manga readers are you know, perhaps they even prefer it. And again, it's the readers who would tell you, this is our format, this is what we read, this is what we enjoy. And this is, makes it unique, it makes it different. But certainly, I think most people understand... Once they've heard why it's flipped, that you're preserving the original content in the way it was originally designed and drawn, there's a good reason for it. In Japan, on the flip side, you can get magazines that you open from the left side or from the right side. You can get books that open from the left side or the right side. There's a kind of a confusion over there because they've been imitating Western publications for a long time and yet have gone back to their own original style. So depending on what's being published where and how, you have these things going all over the place, but everyone seems to accept it as being just the way it's done now. So I don't see any resistance to it.
It was interesting. Yen Press just brought out With the Light, the story of a family raising an autistic child, and
Toward the Light.
No, I think it's With the Light.
With the Light.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, kind of a little funny, a little bit of a funny title. They marketed it. Not so, it's in the graphic novel section, but they're also putting it in child development sections of bookstores. And what's happening is really interesting because I wrote a review of it, so I'm seeing the links and people who come in and comment that, in fact, a lot of people, they're reading it and it's not bothering them. I mean, the reviewers always have to explain why it reads backwards, but the people who actually read it don't seem to have too much trouble with it. So maybe it is a skill. I find every now and then I get confused. more so with manga on the web, where I don't have the context of the book.
Yeah, that makes a big difference. That can make it very difficult.
Yes?
I'm going to jump in and ask questions because I can't pass this up. But it's interesting, very often in this particular argument that you're talking about, flip or not to flip, I've often heard it said that, well, we want to gain more readers by flipping it. And I've never quite understood that, particularly in today's market, because there are so many more readers for unflipped manga, or so it seems. For instance, I know Vertical doesn't flip a lot of its classic manga, or all of it, really.
No, they just, I think it's just the Tezuka stuff.
Just
Tezuka? To Andromeda.
Yes, no, that's right, because
they didn't flip it.
So it's just the Tezuka
didn't
books. But very often, but it's generally explained to me that, well, because we want to get more readers for it. But at the end of the day, I'm really wondering, does that really bring more readers?
I think that was a thought back then.
Well, I think they would still say today, because they continue to do it.
We thought about that. We're doing a book called Me and the Devil Blues, which is a very sophisticated book.
About Robert Johnson?
About the life of Robert Johnson. But it's really, it's a very fantastical tale that says that he really did sell his soul to the devil when he gained his guitar playing talent. So it's a great, great book. The art is fantastic. But we went back and forth in-house. Should we flip this book? The logic is, when you're doing a book like that, that's aimed not so much at the core manga reader as the casual reader who isn't that familiar with manga, you don't want that, you know, reading backwards to be a barrier to keep them from reading it. The problem is that you are, of course, also trying to sell the book to the core manga reader who hates it when the book is flipped. I mean, again, taking a very mercenary sales approach, I can tell you with complete confidence that if we, let's just take Dragon Eye, or especially a title that's like really highly anticipated, if we were to announce that we were releasing it so it reads from left to right, we would lose probably 75% of our sales on that book.
But was there not a point at Viz where they were doing flipped and unflipped editions of the
special
same
editions,
book?
Special editions, yeah.
And they were not, and the unflipped versions weren't selling as well? Do I remember that correctly?
No, there was a period when they did both. And it was when they were transitioning from flipped to unflipped.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what they
found... It wasn't even graphic novels, it was the single volumes, too.
Yeah, I guess it all depends on which period you're talking about. The period I'm thinking of is after they were wrapping up doing the comic books,
mm-hmm.
and they were starting to move over to doing everything unflipped. They always did graphic novels,
mm-hmm.
but they were starting to move everything to being unflipped, and for a while there, they would put the books out in both formats. And pretty quickly learned which ones were selling and stopped doing them in flipped format.
I have one more question for all of you, and then I think we'll throw it open to the audience, because I'm sure you all have questions too. In Japan, and I noticed, Dallas, you brought a magazine.
Mm.
In Japan, you get your monthly or weekly dose, and then in a throwaway format, you get your chapter a week, and then you get to you go out and you buy the book for keeps. In the U.S., we do have Shonen Jump and Shoujo Beat, which are doing that a little bit, which I think is wonderful. This is actually selling me the same book twice, because my kids buy them all. but they're the only ones who have done that. Do you think that it's possible in this country, whether through a print anthology or a web format? And I know it's been a big obstacle for Tokyopop with their global titles, because, you know, some of them are great books, but you have to wait a year to find out what happens next. That anybody's going to come up with a good way to give people their monthly or weekly hit of manga while they wait for the trade, so to speak.
So you're asking me, yeah.
do they sell even the Japanese?
The Shonen Jumps sell quite well, but when not like they used to in our store. We're, again, kind of a destination for the books. I believe the answer would best come from Viz Media. They apparently sell some 300,000 copies a month of Shonen Jump. That might be an older figure now. You may know better than I do. I don't know.
The circulation on Shonen Jump right now is 180,000,
I think.
So it's
dropped considerably.
And the circulation on Shoujo Beat, I want to say, is 35,000.
It's like 30,000, 35,000. It's much lower.
Yeah.
It's on their
press
website.
That's in their press kit.
I know that they were trying to get million sellers out of both of them. That was pressure coming into them from Japan.
Yeah.
They even had Kinokuniya managers go over to Viz offices to talk about it at one point. I don't know what it accomplished, but you know, I don't know. It's a lifestyle thing. Japan is very train-oriented. New York is, but if you go to West Coast or something, it's very car-oriented, and you'd probably be more successful putting something on a CD or, you know, audio. So I think that's why you can pick up your monthly or your weeklies and your monthlies and have people and then go back and get the book for the collector. I would see serious hurdles, especially hearing the figures, to this format as being hugely successful. I think it has a following, but I wouldn't count on it being a bestseller.
How did the Japanese serials sell in the New York Kinokuniya?
Oh, very well, but to a Japanese clientele.
Right.
Those are almost exclusively Japanese native speakers buying those. There are some kids who come in and religiously buy Shonen Jump in Japanese, English-speaking, originally.
Wow. Okay.
But yeah, I don't see a huge number of people who are not native Japanese speakers buying them. Yeah.
One of the things that I like about Chojo B, I'm not crazy about the colored ink, I have to say. It's kind of eye-melting, but I like it because the pages are bigger, and I'm seeing that with the omnibus editions, too. I just was reading the omnibus of Fruits Basket, and boy, I read Fruits Basket, you know, years ago. But it's different with the bigger page. It's a little closer to sort of the way it originally was. It's not shrunk down. So I don't know if that's an advantage to the magazines or not. Brad, do you have any thoughts?
Sorry. Go ahead.
No. I'm just thinking from a marketing standpoint. But just thinking about whether I would buy one or not. I would tend to probably not do the compilation because it might not be as hardcore as perhaps others, but I enjoy certain series and I don't need the other series. I just want to stick with the ones that I like or discover new ones. And I know this is a perfect opportunity to explore new ones.
Discovered.
Yes, yeah. I never really even. I'm so into the actual getting the volumes, I really haven't...
There's another component, though, that you're not aware of, which is really important to realize. This is... Let me see, I'm just going to do a quick check on the page count.
Oh, just the price point?
This is almost 500 pages long. It's a weekly magazine. It's 250 yen. There was a time when that would have been about 250, but with the strength of the dollar these days, that's about $1.50. And so there's more of an incentive in Japan to pay a couple of bucks each week. It's throwaway money. And this, of course, is throwaway.
You pass it among your friends.
Right.
You know, this is printed on newsprint. The ink comes right off on your fingers. Nobody in their right mind holds on to these because they're just so many. Nobody in their right mind holds on to these. Do you know why they're multiple color pages?
Because the paper is so cheap?
It is actually a nod back to history when that was the original reason why it was like this. The 1950s, when they were publishing these magazines, they did in fact use the cheapest paper they could get. And that meant they could not always necessarily get paper of the same color. So it wasn't intentional. It was just a way to keep the prices down. These days, paper management works a lot differently, and even getting the cheapest paper possible, you can decide what color you want. But it's tradition, it's history. Everybody, for decades, it's been multiple colors, so they just continue to do that. Here's the thing about manga magazines in America, and nothing illustrates better this point than the difference in circulation between Shonen Jump and Shoujo B. Shonen Jump sells because it's got properties that are on television. It's in Walmart, it's in Target, it's in some of your grocery stores. The only way it's getting up close to 200,000 circulation, which means that they have to ship out close to 400,000 copies, because probably at least half of those have to be destroyed, which is just the way magazine sales work, is it's driven by properties on television. So, Shoujo Beat doesn't have that. Shoujo Beat has a much more modest circulation. Doesn't mean that Shoujo Beat doesn't achieve what it sets out to do. It works in many ways as a marketing tool and a way to introduce people to series that they might not otherwise be reading. If they're really into, Nana's not the best example because I know that's just about to come out of Shoujo Beat, but if they're into a series and they want to pick it up every month, you know, it's $5 for 250 pages and you get a lot of different stories for it. But the greatest barrier to anybody wanting to do a magazine like that here is that financially it's not going to be worth your while unless you've got Yu-Gi-Oh! Or Naruto on the cover, unless you've got something that big. And right now, Viz are the only people who have that.
And you don't see the web emerging as a lower-priced intermediary?
I absolutely believe in the web as a way to read comics. Our fans are reading comics on the web. You know, I work at Random House, which is a big old-school publisher. A lot of the different departments talk about what percentage of their readers are online. My readers, it's 100%. Everybody reading our books is online. But this kind of goes back to the scanlation problem. It's really difficult for us to charge. It's really difficult for us to charge, and yet we kind of have to. We kind of have
money?
to make some money off of it. It's difficult for us to charge for two reasons. The kids are used to getting it for free, and second, the kids, they don't have credit cards. It's actually really difficult to get anything other than cash out of them. I'm very mercenary about this stuff.
Does anybody have any questions for our panel?
How do you make decisions about sound effects? About that, like which ones get translated, or is it on the case?
Well, they're all translated. All the effects that I come across, when I get the translation in the Japanese files, and we decide to incorporate them into the design or whatever format we use, the translator has gone through and translated everything. So they don't want to leave anything out.
I had a very frustrating experience reading Dragon Head, because there are long sequences where it's just untranslated sound effects.
It's a difference based on different publishers too, and certain public. And it's funny because you can actually pick up a book and publish it on the American side and know just by looking at how the sound effects have been translated. Like Viz rewrites all the sound effects, so you will not see the original Japanese sound written except.
Except. Go ahead.
Okay. And Viz employs a method where they try to use American English sound effects to replace the Japanese ones, which means essentially that most of them are non-intelligible, lots of consonants with no vowels in between type of sound effects. Whereas with Delray, it's great because the translator gets much more flexibility, and some of them are kind of onomatopoeias, and some of them are action words.
Well, actually, I was just about to bring this up. One of the problems you have translating sound effects is that the Japanese sense of onomatopoeia is completely different from the American sense. What's a good example? This is when I first started at Delray, we were doing a sample book. We had a page from Gundam Seed. Somebody had forgotten to translate the sound effect.
Oh.
And so I had to get it translated. I didn't have the translator at hand, so I called up a friend of mine in Tokyo. I said, I just sent you an email. Tell me what that sound effect says. Because I'm figuring, it's going to be boom or something like that. She looks at it, and she says, it's the sound of something appearing suddenly from the dark.
I usually have dictionary and a couple of other translator friends that I pass things around to, honestly.
We went with whoosh.
One great example of that actually is Carl Horn's notes to Kurosagi Corpse Delivery Service.
Oh, that's exactly what I was going to point out. This is one that all the stuff that we letter for happens to be for Delray, so that's, I'm very fortunate that we don't have any issues. But the Corpse Service was amazing. I bought this, I loved the artwork, it looked fantastic, I loved even the jacket of it. I started flipping through it because I was going to hold off to read later, and I noticed that the FXs weren't translated. But you have to go to the back of the book, reference it by page and panel, and they tell you they give you like an index, which I thought was the...
But it's things like the sound of a body sinking underwater. They're not things that we would think of as sounds particularly.
I think if I would ever go back and do this over, if we wanted another way to market manga in a new format to make people buy it more, would be to actually put a sound effects like index or glossary in the back with what they are, not just what they sound like, but what they mean. I mean, I just realized this was another series that I'm working on, that there's a sound it was accompanied by little foxfires. And it was this guy who was so depressed that he was like a ghost. And it was like, I ended up going with gloom, But it was really the sound, it's literally the sound of someone so depressed that they might as well be suicidal. You know, I mean, you literally need a sentence for almost every single sound effect. I mean, some of them are easy, like kaboom, blast, leap, you know, but there's some that require explanation.
Once in a blue moon, I do get more than the kaboom, and it almost looks funny in my eye because the sound effects that we have are sometimes so simplified to those single words that I'm given like four words or five words to explain this, and then I'll have to write a note saying, should we treat this as an aside, like a thought on the side rather than an effect? And do you mind if I remove, you know, it has to get into whether we remove the sound effect visually and put a thought there rather than a, you know, a literal sound effect that you would hear with your ear, door closing or something. And if it is the gloom and a suicidal, you know, like, oh, I feel very, you know, suicidal, do we remove it and treat it as a thought outside the bubble? And then those are questions I unfortunately kick back to you guys, and you leave the responsibility for you.
I'm curious about what other genres out there may sneak into the marketplace. I mean, I'm hearing more and more that obviously the big selling titles at the top of the list, they're going gangbusters, but it's becoming harder and harder to introduce new genres. And of course, that just from what you said earlier today, this is a little bit depressing because this is a very thin, what we see is really such a small slice of really the incredible diversity of the market. So, I mean, I'm a big fan of, you know, of manga science fiction, like Shiro Masamune, of which, of course, you can get his books here, but they don't really seem to be selling that well. So what can we expect to see from a publisher? Obviously, you've got to sell a book, but what are you going to do to try to create, you know, new readers and get new series into the marketplace?
Wow, it's really hard because, you know, as a publisher, publishing manga, and as a group of people, all of us who really, really like manga and really care about it, we want to introduce these new series. We want to introduce these series that are a little more sophisticated in some ways. The problem is it's a catch-22. How much money can you put into launching a series that you actually already know isn't going to sell very well? Do you, on a limited budget, put your money into the next big shonen series that you have every indication is going to be a big deal, and this will get us that extra bit more and brighten the picture overall? All we can do at the end of the day is try to publish those works. And so we publish things like Nodame, we publish Eternal Sabbath, we publish Parasite. But you're not allowed to quote this on Publishers Weekly. On the record, I have now just listed for you some of our they're great books, and in fact, we have a responsibility to publish them. We have to. I mean, we have to. If we don't, we're going to end up with a bunch of carbon copy clones, the same thing over and over again, which, again, from a sales perspective, is fantastic. But from the point of view of being somebody who is, for example, just ecstatic over the fact that Vertical is going to release Tezuka's Blackjack, which is going to have a very small audience, but I'll be one of them.
I might even buy it because I don't understand all the medical lingo in it.
We have to do it, and we take the best shot we can. We're doing some things to push Me and the Devil Blues, because that's a great-looking, unusual, really, really different type of manga. I wish that I'd had the foresight to bring a copy here to pass it around so you guys could see the art.
What's the pub date on that? When's it coming out?
Trisha?
It's August 08.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, I've got time.
Well, and you know, the reason why it's August 08 is because we have delayed it a few times because we're trying to get blurbs. We're trying to get quotes from notable people outside of the manga industry. Because it's a title that we can't take out an ad in Entertainment Weekly and say everybody read this manga. But if we can get if we can get authors, musicians, different people outside the manga business to actually say, yeah, this was actually pretty cool, then we can start some buzz for it. That's what we're trying to do over the next 10 months, actually 9 months.
As a manga reader since I could read pretty much, it makes me sad too. I mean, it's just a fact that and it's happening in Japan too, unfortunately, that literacy, not literacy, but the reading public is not very big. I mean, again, the main readership for manga titles, what makes or breaks the, you know, whether they really cut it or not, is if there's an anime tie-in. There aren't too many manga series that are selling just as standalone manga series. Manga series are not picked up unless anime series. I mean, Saint Seiya is, you know, really does well everywhere else except America. And it wasn't even, I was pitching it for several years before Deke picked up the anime. It was only after Deke picked up the anime that Viz finally gave the green light to Saint Seiya. And to its justice, Viz is going through with the entire 28-volume series because it's not selling very well, you know? And it's only selling because of all the diehard fans, English reading diehard fans that are out there. And it really makes me sad because, like I said in the beginning, there's so many good series from the 80s and 90s and even 70s that, you know, publishers are by every right not gonna want to pick up unless they already have a couple of successful titles and they can throw in a, you know, a not too well-selling title, because they're excellent series all by themselves, but they're just not gonna sell. There's no anime tie-in, especially for series back then. And, you know, unfortunately, in a market that's driven by the art style, because it's also driven by the anime, they're not willing to see titles for the plot over the art. The art usually, first it's the anime tie-in, then it's usually the visual style, and then it's the plot. And it's partly because, you know, I don't think there's as much prose readership or manga readership here as there is in Japan, and even in Japan with video games, and I think manga readership probably has dropped in Japan too, or just
well, magazine sales are certainly going down. Graphic novel or tankobon sales are coming up, but not as rapidly as magazine sales are coming down.
I'm kind of curious, John, because you can have a different mix of customers. What is walking out? Is it, do your customers mostly also buy the classic kind of shoujo shonen series with the anime tie-ins, or do you have a huge Jose?
Well, our customers buy everything. Obviously, we do better with certain things than others. As I said, Valkyrie has been kind of the unparalleled bestseller in the store, but we do very well with Naruto, too. And again, we have the bestsellers in Japanese that don't do so well in English, at least in our store. And then we have the, you know, of course, very serious customers looking for things and teaching us what we should be carrying because we didn't think that they would do very well, but here it is, people are coming and looking for it. So yeah, there's a lot. I mean, and that's why I say it is a battle for shelf space.
Yeah.
Because the buyer's like trying to calculate. The latest thing that was interesting to me was we thought Pokemon was dead. Literally dead. And we just stopped buying it. And then suddenly the kids were coming in, like a new generation of kids were coming and asking for it. And so the buyer just said, oh, it's dead. We don't want to do anything with it. And I said, well, try it. So we threw it out and started picking up, and now it's back. It's back.
It's,
I don't know.
It's
great.
On book scan charts again.
Yeah.
It's yeah. You see it. We see a top 50 list every week, and there's a Pokemon book on there almost every week now.
Right. So, will Yu-Gi-Oh come back? I don't know.
Hasn't been back in some time. So.
Pokemon, there was a very carefully calculated public relations campaign that they ran into wars and they go and bring that back literally from the dead. And they really worked to try to find whole new audience for that. But it was definitely something that they tried for.
Yeah, you're right. It didn't happen organically.
No.
When Pokemon caught fire, it happened overnight. And in 2000, when Pokemon died, that happened overnight too. It really, I was at Biz at the time, and then just suddenly was gone. I mean, it went from selling millions to nothing in like 3 months.
What happened to Hamtaro?
Hamtaro never really got off the ground.
Yeah.
I think I'm getting perilously close to violating my non-disclosure.
Actually, we could have figured that out by ourselves. I think you're cool. It's public domain. Calvin, do you have another question?
I forget, but what was I going to say? So what are we to make of publishing programs such as, and not to play off any publishing program against any other one, I know you're all out there doing the best you can. but the kind of things that Dark Horse is publishing now, I mean, they seem to be going out of their way to publish manga that the market isn't necessarily asking for. Thank God. some of my favorite series are published by Dark Horse. For better or for worse, Gunsmith Cats. Or, for instance, Tekken King Creek from Viz. A wonderful book, yet who's buying that? Who do you think is going to be? Well, there you go. I bought a copy,
but it was to replace my original.
In fact, I bought it. Books sent to me. I would have bought it myself. But yeah. I'm curious. I mean, I think these are laudable publishing efforts. But I'm curious. Yeah, maybe you can. What's the strategy behind this kind of publishing, where perhaps there isn't a gigantic demand?
Well, this is my theory about Dark Horse and their manga plan. First of all, Tekken King Creed. I think it's actually pretty straightforward. There was a movie, and they were releasing the movie. So clearly, I mean, any publisher is going to release the book, succeed or fail. You kind of have to.
In this giant. Incredible. I mean,
yeah, I'm glad they did.
Yeah, I'm glad
I really like the format.
Yeah, no,
and I think it helps to get a little more attention for the book. But so anyway, so that release is pretty much a given. This is my theory about Dark Horse. Dark Horse has always been primarily a comic book publisher. Now, for those of you familiar with how these things are distributed, there are essentially two markets for any form of comic book, manga or otherwise. The direct diamond market and the bookstore market.
Yeah.
The bookstore market is returnable. The diamond market is not. The bookstore market adopted manga. The diamond market did not, because they didn't understand it, and anything that they buy, they can't return, so they have to be risk averse. Because they are risk averse, they tend to go with what they know. So, this is all very complicated. It's like the manga event horizon. So, here comes manga from Dark Horse. They know Dark Horse. Mm-hmm. They've had a relationship with Dark Horse for 20 years. So they release manga, Diamond buys it, the comic stores buy it. It sells through because the comic store customer is mostly males in their 20s to 40s, which is mostly what Dark Horse is publishing. It's mostly where it's oriented. Those books are non-returnable, and so you have a pretty solid, mm-hmm. small account to ship those books into. Only Dark Horse can do that. Del Rey can't do it, Viz can't do it, Tokyopop can't do it. We don't have the relationship with the comic book shops that a Dark Horse does. And that's my theory as to why Dark Horse picks up all those books that in the bookstore market don't have a really big audience, but in that dedicated core market that they do service, it's a small audience, but clearly it's big enough to justify continuing publishing the books.
So essentially Marvel and DC would have a leg up in that regard too, then.
Mm. Oh.
You see a mix booming in the.
They've been mouthing that they are looking into bringing manga over. They're certainly collaborating with manga artists,
right?
On current Marvel and DC titles.
Okay, I'm a loudmouth, and I should absolutely not be saying this in a public place, but here we go. Here's the two mistakes CMX made that pretty much doomed them in this market. Number one, they launched with weak titles. Now, I'm not talking about the quality of the books by any means. I think CMX publishes some really excellent books. But in terms of sales potential, they launched with several books that were taken from the 1970s and 1980s.
Yeah.
American fans, probably not the fans in this room, but American fans absolutely wholeheartedly reject anything that looks like it was done before 1995. And even that gets a little bit too old. So what happened to the comic book shops was, here comes DC, same exact situation as with Dark Horse. They come in, they say, we have manga. The comic stores go, we don't know manga, we trust you. Again, vast overgeneralization. There's plenty of comic stores out there that do know manga. But they bring in these books, they don't sell, and they don't order manga from them anymore. Then, of course, there was the Tenjo Tenge fiasco. CMX acquired a title, Tenjo Tenge, by Oh Great. That is It's pornographic, basically. I'm trying very hard not to make a value judgment about it. But the content is absolutely mature, rated X content. Mm-hmm. They took that book and they edited it so that it could get a teen rating.
So it's safe to assume that DC didn't know what they were doing when they published it.
I didn't say that. All I can say to you is that it was pretty clear that by doing that, on the one hand, they had squandered the goodwill with the comic shops. Then with that effort, they squandered the goodwill with the fans. And from that point on, and it's a real shame because, again, they published some really good books. Emma's a fantastic book. It's a manga I highly recommend. But a lot of people in a lot of camps will avoid the CMX brand now.
Which is actually a shame because I don't think people who are responsible for that are even still there anymore.
No.
I suppose Suzuki took over after that.
Yeah, and she knows what she's doing.
And Jim Chadwick have really kind of, they've brought out some really interesting books. Emma was one of them. And also, actually, CMX is a nice brand when I'm looking for, you know, all ages titles. They do some stuff that I can, you know, hand to my nieces and nephews and say, here, you can read this.
Yeah, they just did a horror manga called Presence. I'm forgetting who the mangaka was, but, you know, I picked it up. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it's really different. That's really the other thing they're doing. And they're doing what you did. They're doing the horror titles with, like, a slightly larger format. You know,
they're doing their mature titles in the larger format.
Is that it?
Yeah. Anything that they feel rates a mature label, they pretty much stole the format from us.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Okay, so when talking about like weird stuff, weird titles or things that are not the standard mainstream things, what do you think the relationship is between the stuff that comes out here and there and doesn't really like do too much, like sales or popularity wise, and like in Japan, how they come out in the anthologies where they're mixed in with the more popular stuff, you know, with a greater balance so that the readership there is more just accustomed to just having it around so that just more visibility for these sorts of oddball things that we don't have here because it's straight to the final product, where it seems to me that it's just structured completely differently here. The same product, you know, just in a different language, is structured fundamentally differently, so people are going to react to it differently, whereas things can't catch on with the same intensity.
I think that's a really good point with regard to the anthologies. It's like back when I was young, we had these things called records that had a bunch of songs on them. Yeah, they're like CDs. You would buy it because there was one song that got played on the radio all the time. Then there were like six or
seven. Oh, the B-side.
Yeah. But like there would be like seven songs you'd never heard before, and some of them would be good, you know. So you would end up liking them too. And I really see that kind of serendipity, and you know, certainly I see Viz using that with Shoujo Beat and Shonen Jump because they'll introduce a new manga and run a couple of chapters of it, and. And I think that's one of the reasons why I would like to see an anthology, actually. So that when
like the reason Viz was able to put out the, I'm just going to say Black and White so easily is that they already had it just sitting around in their vaults because they published it.
That's true, too.
10 years before, and it was just like they just had to, they didn't even change it or flip it back around. They just stapled it together and pushed it out.
It's a little different from Viz, though.
Well, because
they're not licensing
it. Like, it was already here when that one came out, for example, and there was already a small, like, readership for that particular book, for example, just because it had been anthologized here in their anthologies they had at the time. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think that it sort of warms the stage, I think, for certain things.
Well, I think anthologies are great. I do. It's just in the market, you know, companies the size of Viz, Tokyo Pop, or Del Rey, we only want to play this game if we can play big. And the only way, for my way of thinking, to do an anthology book like that and get the kind of numbers is you got to have a lead-in that's on TV. You got to have a lead-in that, if not on TV, is at least generating just such a huge amount of buzz that you can count on a lot of people coming every month to get that one story.
What about the internet? I mean, I asked my 14-year-old daughter the other day, if you wanted to advertise a comic, how would you do it? She said, LiveJournal, because, as I was saying to Dallas, LiveJournal and DeviantArt is where she gets all her recommendations.
And that's a really good point. It's hard to separate the signal out from the noise when it comes to advertising. I think there's more we could be doing ourselves to advertise online. But, you know, for example, we're putting up 20-page chapters, first chapters of all the books we do.
Right.
Are on our website.
And do those get read?
They do. They do get read, but...
And all the publishers put out those sneak peek anthologies, at least, which are...
Yeah, but those are only distributed at the conventions, typically. Oh, some of them put them in at the bookstores, don't they?
Yeah, and at grab bags at events and stuff like that.
Yeah, and those are nice. Those are a great way for us to get the word out, too.
Tokyo Pop right now, I have on my computer, because I downloaded it, little Gekku and Alice widget, which sits on my computer, counts down the days until the release date, and gives me a new teeny tiny page every day. And I have to say, that's very clever.
It is.
That's the kind of thing my kids would love.
It is. It's a very clever piece of promotion.
But I don't know. Tokyo Pop, too, with their website, is really trying to do the social marketing. And I'd say that's a bit of a mixed bag.
I have to find out how, if it ever launched, but there is a huge Naruto tie-in thing in Japan on their and on Shueisha's website that they were having me translate parts of at one point, but I don't know if it actually ever launched. There is like a Naruto Academy, I think, off of Viz's page. So I think the web is definitely needs to be more utilized, but in terms of launching new titles, again, the way that Viz does it is by putting the first chapter or two in Shonen Jump or Shoujo Beat.
Right.
You know, and I think it's partly just the limitation of the American printing industry, not even the publishing industry, but the printing industry too, where Japan just spews out so much more paper.
One kind of interesting model is Netcomics, where you buy a chapter, like they put out a chapter every week or so of different books, which they're a Korean company called eComics, so they already have a huge library of web manhwa, which they simply have to translate, and they put their first, sort of, it's like their first draft goes up on the web, and it's a quarter a chapter. And the reason that it works, kind of, is that you buy, like, you can't just go out and buy one chapter. You buy like a $10 pass, so you take your credit card and you do $10. Well, you know, it is so easy to spend money when you've already spent it. Like, yeah, sign me up for 3 more chapters, because I've already spent the money anyway.
But is that because they already have the licenses to the titles that they're putting
They don't out? Even have to license them, because they're Korean. So they are the publisher.
Oh,
I see. Yeah. But that's what I mean. That's part of the limitation, I think, for other publishers would be the cost of the license.
To put it on the web. It's often, they don't like you to put it on the web.
The cost of the license, and then the cost of all the intervening, because even with webcomics, you're still going to need some lettering,
right?
And you're still going to need translation. So it's all that added cost too. Is quarter a chapter sounds pretty, like, nice, but
I suspect they're loss leaders for their books seem to sell.
Yeah, if I can make a comment on that, long before manga became bestseller material in Publishers Weekly section, the Tokyo Pop titles were always the best-selling titles in our store. And I just think that they were very good at the guerrilla-type marketing. You know, they just knew how to get in on the ground, pick people up, get them on the web, do all that, and they were very good at it. And they were good at choosing their titles, too. You may have a comment on that from your point of view.
Oh, no, actually, I just agree.
Yeah, they really did a good job. But they've just become kind of overshadowed by Giant Viz and Coming of Del Rey, I suppose. Because they got these huge titles, the Naruto's and the Yu-Gi-Oh's and things like that. So, but they're still in there doing a good job, I think.
Yes.
Is there any dramas that you'd like to see published here?
Martin's actually been waiting all night.
Well, that's because I always like to do my little spiel of this is what I'd like to translate if I suddenly won the lottery. But I mean, being a veterinarian, I always want to put out more animal-related manga. And there's a couple of really big series. The most obvious for anyone who's really, really into comics is there's actually a series about veterinarians. And in fact, I've just heard that there's another one as well. Because until now, we've only had the evil veterinarian in Tokyo Babylon.
That's good PR.
Bad PR. But this is actually called The Animal Doctor, and it trails two high school boys from their last year of high school through veterinary school in Japan, and it's actually based on an actual veterinary college in Japan that the author did 2 months of research at. And I was actually in Japan as a college student myself, just observing the school, and they're like, oh, did you read the manga? so-and-so is based on Professor so-and-so. I mean, it's really true, and it's and reading it as a veterinarian now, too, it's amazing how much detail some mangaka go into researching their thing. There's all sorts of sports manga now that Slam Dunk is coming out in English, but there's figure skating. I have a figure skating comic book here. A lot more high fantasy, not just kind of like high school romance fantasy, but true fantasy from even like a prose fantasy standpoint. There are a lot of mythology-based series that I've been pitching to various companies, but the art's too old. But yeah, I mean, there are a couple of series there that are based on Egyptian mythology. Obviously, my...
You mean like Yu-Gi-Oh?
Yu-Gi-Oh. No. And can be enjoyed by men as well. But I mean, like...
You mean like Yu-Gi-Oh?
Saint Seiya is based on Greek mythology, but no, I mean, there's like Celtic mythology series, and there's one that I really like that's called Tales from the Banks of the Nile, and it's an Egyptian mythology, and I'll show it up now. But, I mean, another interesting genre that is actually a prose genre that's ancillary to manga is there's a lot of ancillary books to manga in Japan that don't get over to the U.S. a lot, and some of them, it's probably because they're kind of almost like fiction, in a way that there are other people not licensed by the publisher writing books about that series. But there are a couple that are actually, I think, put out by the publisher too. Like, for example, there's actually this book about Blackjack series that actually is, it's three volumes, and it actually covers all the medical conditions that appear in Blackjack, which are actual medical conditions, because Tezuka was actually an MD.
Yes, he was.
And it's a prose book, but it has scenes from that. And this was not written by Tezuka. It was written by someone way after his death. But it actually covers which chapter, which volume the story comes out in, and what parts of it are accurate, which parts, obviously, he took poetic license with. There are books about the allegorical metaphors in Sailor Moon. And, you know, I mean, wow. There's practically anything you ever, like, thought about in manga written in prose. And, I mean, Kinokuniya and other Japanese bookstores in the United States do carry them in Japanese, but that's kind of like a whole other type of genre, too. People just have too much time on their hands.
I
mean,
I was really impressed when I was in Kinokuniya today with the selection of art books, too, like related to different manga. It was really impressive.
The
I know that a lot of them have been coming out in English. But
so please come to Kinokuniya.
Of course.
We have a question here.
Yeah, I do have a question. It's obviously a very small niche, but in the past few years, there's sort of been an entry into libraries and institutions. And as an aside, I know that these things have like sort of been this, now the only market for university presses and stuff. But do you have any comments about this entry? I mean, is it any introductory value to new readers, or are these sales any bit significant, or?
Oh yeah, library sales are absolutely significant. I mean, you're right that it's in the minority of the books that we sell, but it's absolutely significant. We have people dedicated to the library market from a sales perspective. Our marketing team tries to work with libraries. And I think that there's a lot to be said for having manga in libraries, because, you know, most of these kids come in and they read the manga, and, you know, then they want it. And very often they'll come in and they want to read an entire series, and it's very rare the entire series is going to be there in the stores. So it really helps us sell more books. And the libraries have been at the forefront of manga for years. Absolutely for years. Once they realized that these were the books that were bringing in this whole class of teenagers, not class, but this whole group of teenagers who weren't going into libraries anymore, you know, they really started to stock up.
You think college campuses too. I mean, back in my generation, being in my early to mid-30s, the first place that a lot of people came in contact with manga was at their college anime club. And, you know, they would have a weekly manga swap to whether it was English or in the original Japanese. And my alma mater, actually, Cornell, had at that time the largest collection of both untranslated and untranslated manga. I don't even know if they had how much of a collection of translated manga they had. So I think, as you know, I don't know how much more. I think now more the public libraries are a bigger step, because you are getting younger and younger readerships. But I think for, you know, college students, I think it's still great that more and more college campuses are also having
you know, at public libraries, I think a lot of people are not aware, I certainly wasn't, that those libraries receive their funding based on how many books are actually checked out. So manga is a godsend for them, because let's face it, even a slow reader is going to get through this in a few hours.
Of course.
Read it, come back, return it, and get as much as they can to take home again. So they actually get more money because they are having more books checked out when they have a big manga section.
And I was impressed at New York Comic Con, like, how many librarians were there? That was, there was like, they were a big...
Well, there was librarian day. I mean, there was a whole day of programming for librarians.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're doing that again this week at the New York Anime Festival.
New York Anime Festival, Friday through Sunday, jack.
Did I miss the discussion about Maui?
No.
Oh, Calvin.
Maui.
Just everybody just tell him yes. Yes, Calvin.
Well, because I wouldn't have wanted to miss it.
What do you want to know?
I just love to hear you talk a bit about the fine points of Yahoo.
it's a popular category, or so it seems to be.
It's
a popular
It was surprising for me in 1995 when I was in Japan, when my cousin was like, oh, you like manga, come here, you gotta see this. And it was when yaoi first started hitting the Japanese market, and back then it wasn't even really graphic, it was more just plot. And then the way it's boomed first in Japan and now in the United States, it is kind of surprising for me. I totally didn't see that trend coming. But I've also had to explain where it was a format for women to feel comfortable reading in a mixed gender atmosphere without feeling that they might be harassed by men. That's one explanation for how it got started.
I don't normally bring my political views to the table for something for talking about manga, but I'm going to this time because I've already gotten myself in so much trouble. but you know, I'm a big advocate for gay rights, and so anything that helps our culture accept gay people more, I think is absolutely a good thing. I think it's absolutely wonderful that there's as much yaoi manga published as there is, and it actually makes me very sad. We license all of our manga from Kodansha. And Kodansha does not publish a great deal of yaoi manga, so it's a field that we really haven't been able to get into. But me personally, I think it's great that it's out there. I'm very glad that it's so popular.
Although, on the other hand, there's been some controversy, I should say, because not the gay community isn't necessarily completely aware of the yaoi phenomenon. There is some crossover, but it's not a total crossover. And there's some controversy both about content and about audience. I mean, yaoi manga was created mainly by straight women for a straight female audience. And there's a lot of violence in it. There's a lot of implied or implicit rape, as well as actual rape. There's a lot of kind of almost a domination submission kind of subgenre within it. So it's been controversial because it's allowed, there have been more gay male authors coming out with gay content as well, but that's almost considered a different genre. You know, there is an adult male on male genre in Japan as well that is barely hit the surface here. And then there's also the yuri manga phenomenon, which actually is drawn for the most part by women who are queer for a queer woman audience. And that's a whole nother controversy because most of that is actually not graphic enough by some standards. Because then you run into the whole hentai thing, which...
Yeah.
You know, it's straight for straight men writing for straight male audience too. So it's good, and this is where my political, I guess, views kind of get muddied into the picture. But it's both good and bad. I mean, I think it's great that gay American readers can read it and get out of it what Dallas points out is seeing gay male content, you know, in Borders and Barnes and Nobles and that kind of thing, but in terms of the original cultural context, it's a little conflicting, I guess. Yeah.
If I can just add an anecdote, we started carrying yaoi comics, and we did some book signings with Central Park Media, and we were putting the books out, we made this assumption, oh, it's going to bring in more gay clientele. When we had the book signing, I've never seen so many young screaming women. Literally going crazy. We thought we had almost a Beatles concert going on. They were going wild, and I didn't see one gay male in the audience.
Well, now you find out what the audience was.
Yeah, well, actually,
clearly. Yeah.
I have a question, which is, if you go to a gay specialty bookstore, are you going to see any yaoi titles at all? I mean, are there any sales at all to the gay specialty book clients?
Men, I don't think so, but you have ALC, which is pretty much the main / only Yuri, translated Yuri publisher and original English language Yuri publisher here in the United States, just based out of New Jersey. And they do sell, and they sell through Prism Comics, which is probably one of the only, I can't remember if they're a distributor or a publisher themselves of gay and lesbian.
They're a publisher.
Yeah. So, you know, definitely, you know, there is some, I mean, there's a healthy body and growing body through Prism of gay comics by American comic artists too. And I think but I don't remember them really carrying any yaoi specifically. Something I can definitely ask though. Yeah. Not yet.
I think one question is, what's going to be, I almost see the yaoi thing at this point peaking. You know, there's a huge amount of content coming out. The quality is somewhat uneven. And there's a limit to how much anybody can buy. So I think the thing that I would be wondering is, what's the next yaoi?
I'm wondering too. Anybody know?
Are we about to turn into pumpkins? I see you looking here, Gina. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So we have time for one more question from the audience.
Yeah. One more question.
I'm not a question, but after the last question, I want to bump it back to Gina. I know there's two events coming up here at MoCA that you'll probably want to tell people in this audience about.
Metro Anime. Michael Chin can talk about the Metro Anime event next week, which is December 10th.
And
Speak the words. as you saw, these are little flyers for our activity next.
If you guys
next
noticed
Monday. Back in the summer was the 10th anniversary of the release of Mai no Hime in Japan, which turned out to be Walt Disney's first release to theaters for Miramax Films. Now, I know someone will say about Kiki's Delivery Service, but that was only to festivals.
Yes.
Okay.
Is Miramax Walt Disney though?
Yeah, they bought it.
No, I thought it was
like
and they screwed
them back.
They screwed the Weinstein.
They screwed the Weinstein.
They screwed them really good too. but anyway, so this was their first release. And actually, I'll be doing it's a very one of the concerns they had was so called it was very Japanese, and I have sort of some interest in this thing about cultural context and cultural communication. So I'm actually going to just give a brief introduction to it. And then we'll show it, and may hopefully have time for a discussion. I decided to restrict my comments mostly to folk belief and religion and human-animal relations. I'll be dividing that up into two periods, sort of in pre-consolidation to post-consolidation. You might have been, don't worry about that. and then...
Sounds provocative.
Yeah. No, it's pretty boring stuff. That's why I'm trying to be as brief as possible.
And then on the 17th, the week after that, we are having the Cartoonist Roundtable, which is a group that meets here, is having a holiday party, which is an open invitation. If you'd like to come and talk to some cartoonists, please feel free.
Wow, now actually that's a great one, but I was actually thinking about the next book club.
Okay, it's actually going to be at the end of January. So the end of January we are reading Yatsuba. Is certainly very fantastic, and you should all come and talk about it because, you know, a cute green haired heroine is just amazing and lots of fun to read and talk about.
Good stuff.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you, for panelists, for coming, and thank you, audience.